It's actually quite difficult for people with integrity to serve in politics. We do need people with integrity. We do need to support them. We do need to get behind them. We do need to pray for politicians who profess to be Christian. But actually, it's not easy. It's not easy because there are lots of games being played. There are lots of sort of manipulations, and it's all very Machiavellian. And to navigate your way through that can actually be pretty tricky.
Welcome to Independence, the FYEC podcast. It's time for an In The News special. We recorded our In The News last week. But we
about a bonus episode?
You could call it that. We will see how we get on. That was Adrian Reynolds, our Head of National Ministries. Hello. Adrian. Yeah. And John Steemers, our National Director, is here as well. Hello, John. Now, we thought in the new year that there were lots of lessons of leadership that have happened kind of over the Christmas break at the back end of 2024 and at the beginning of this year. Lots of different things we can learn, things we can think about. So what we're going to do is take four or five leaders. We'll see how we get on and see what lessons we can learn from their leadership for our leadership of churches. So that's the plan for this next half an hour or so. And we're going to start with Jimmy Carter. So Jimmy Carter died aged 100 over the Christmas break. His funeral was held earlier in this week that we're recording. He was US president for one term, elected in 1976.
Which is very unusual, actually, post-war.
Okay. And then in 1980, Ronald Reagan swept to power. But interestingly, Jimmy Carter, not a popular president at the time, but seems to have become more popular after his presidency, and everything he did rooted in his faith, his Christian faith.
Who wants to go first?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, people have celebrated Carter for his integrity, for his character. He's been described as the best ex-president that America ever had. Yeah. I do think he was a man who was president in an extraordinarily difficult period in the mid-1970s. There was all the problem of the oil crisis. It was economically very, very difficult. There were lots of social upheaval issues. That was the point of significant world sort of terrorism.
It was true all around the world, wasn't it?
In the Middle East. Yeah. It was the time of the Iranian Revolution, and his record was to some extent coloured by the Iranian Revolution and the seizing of the hostages in a failed attempt to try to rescue them. So he was president at an extraordinarily difficult time. And sometimes in the life of a nation or a stage of the life of the world, actually the events that are happening around you are extraordinarily difficult. Mm. He also, of course, became president after the resignation of Ronald Reagan and Gerald Ford. So he came into office at a time. Nixon, and then Ford. So he, in a sense, was dealt a very difficult hand and has been criticised for sort of in his presidency and what he achieved. But it was an extraordinarily difficult time. I mean, he achieved some amazing things. I mean, the peace deal between Israel and Egypt was an extraordinary step in terms of ending war and the steps towards peace. And they're still building on that in the Middle East.
For Egypt to recognise Israel as a nation at that stage was an extraordinary step, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And he was... He was, I think, respected for his integrity. He said when he was elected, I'm not going to lie, he wasn't a politician who played the game in that way. He wanted to be different. He did speak about his faith. He described himself as a born-again evangelical. Now, none of us know him personally, and he was more on the progressive left social justice end of evangelicalism. If you don't think he's an evangelical, he was at the very least somebody who was strongly religiously influenced in public life, and that shaped the way that he behaved.
And he said he'd never separate them either. He'd never separate public office from his faith, which is also a mark of integrity.
Absolutely. And he did fight for justice concerns. I mean, remember, it's not many years in the South since there had been segregation and overt racism. And Jimmy Carter had stood against that. I was reading there was a sort of a Billy Graham Association meeting that people in his area were not wanting to go to because of Billy Graham's anti-segregationist views. And he, in a sense, stood up for it and promoted it. So Jimmy Carter was one at the forefront of wanting to overcome some of those deeply embedded racist policies that had been operative within American culture. And you think about subsequent presidents who came after him, many of whom have significant marks against their presidency for various issues. So Ronald Reagan was caught up in all the deceit of the Iran-Contra affair. Bill Clinton was obviously affected by the Monica Lewinsky scandal. George W. Bush, there's all of the sort of the invasion of Iraq and what took place sort of there. We have Donald Trump, who's been found guilty of fraud and has been found guilty of kind of sexual abuse in a kind of a civil case. So there's a history of presidents who have not, in a sense, maintained publicly that integrity that was a mark of Jimmy Carter's life. And it's a good thing to have people who are like that in public life, who value truth, who value kind of character, who are concerned for justice and putting injustice right.
Now, one of the things, go on.
It said he was elected because he wasn't Gerald Ford, because he didn't have the taint of the of the Republican Party and everything that happened in the 70s. He'd been governor of Georgia, hadn't he, I think? But he hadn't really had any experience of Washington. And I think reading some of the obituaries and some of the commentaries since his death have basically said that that was both the reason he got elected and the reason he didn't get re-elected. That he was both not tainted by everything that had gone on in Washington, but actually was just a little bit too naive about how Washington worked. And therefore, he had integrity and he spoke truth according to his principles, which we might or might not share. I've got to be honest about that. But yeah, he wasn't actually able to play the politicking game and work out, you know, exactly what was going on in Washington and how different parties played themselves off against one another, which was partly the reason that perhaps he didn't get more done than he might have wanted to. So it's an interesting conundrum there, that actually the sort of the integrity and the truth that we might admire, whether or not we agree with his policies, were also in some measure responsible for his downfall as a president, not being able to serve a second term, which I think is just a reminder that it's actually quite difficult for people with integrity to serve in politics. We do need people with integrity. We do need to support them. We do need to get behind them. We do need to pray for politicians who profess to be Christian. But actually, it's not easy. It's not easy because there are lots of games being played. There are lots of sort of manipulations, and it's all very Machiavellian. And to navigate your way through that can actually be pretty tricky.
I thought it was really interesting to note that since he'd been president, he didn't go in for any kind of big ticket speaking events where he'd earn a lot of money. So a lot of former presidents will go and speak at big events, make lots of money from that. And he was quoted as saying he didn't have any problem with other presidents doing that, but he never wanted to. And again, that's another kind of sign of his integrity, I think.
I think that's right. And after office, he continued doing the things that he'd been doing in office. So as we said, he was a peacemaker and he continued to play that role. He continued to be a mediator. People called him in to significant disputes.
And a farmer.
Group.
He was fighting against peanut. Was it peanut blight? Or I can't remember what it's called. Very, very specific farming problem that was on the west coast of Africa. He fought against that.
And he won the Nobel Peace Prize for having done that. And I think that is a recognition of his work in that area. And it's actually, there's a lesson there for pastors and leaders, isn't it? Even when you step down from office, you continue to serve. And actually, you don't just do things solely because you've got a job and a position. So he continued pursuing the very same causes that he was committed to when he was office, when he no longer had quite
Yes, but John, he didn't do that, or he didn't appear to do that to me with a sort of a wanting to have a national profile. And I think that's quite an important lesson for those who retire. I think, you know, retirement for church leaders is not a promotion. It's not a promotion to a bigger ministry. You know, now I've served in a local church, I can grant my wisdom to the whole world. And I think perhaps we have too much of that, too much of people who feel they've served very faithfully in a church. And now, you know, let's set up Adrian Reynolds Inc. Ministries to go and serve in a wider church. I think that the sort of model where you're humbly serving in the ways that you can, in the ways that you're asked to, without wanting to make a song or dance of it. You know, perhaps we're reading too much into his motives, but as it appears to be, I think that's a very commendable way to retire.
And I read in one of his obituaries, he carried on leading the Sunday school at his church.
That's right,
after being president.
Yeah, I mean, he said that lots of people went to the church just so they could have their picture taken with him, and he never tired of doing that, which was a wonderful little description.
I mean, I agree with that. He carried on doing the same things, but not in the same public profile way, but behind the scenes. But there wasn't a sort of a change in who he was and what he was committed to, and he continued to serve and support those things. I think also it's worth that, in a sense, the way Jimmy Carter was perceived reflects the ways that evangelicalism was developing and shifts and changes there. So in 1976, when he was elected and he was a self-confessed born-again evangelical, I think it was Time magazine declared it the year of the evangelical because he was in the public profile there. But over a period of time, it was clear that a section of evangelicalism became more conservative than he would have been. So, for example, he was personally, I think, opposed to homosexuality and relationships, but yet it favoured the gay rights of those who were in the LGBT community. He was personally opposed to kind of abortion, but recognised Roe v. Wade as the law within the states. And some of those positions that he held came to be seen as being outside of the evangelical pale by those who adopted a sort of a more conservative approach. So at one level, evangelicalism changed and fractured sort of after the time of his presidency.
Well, one last thing to say about him, which he was very, very devoted to his family and had a very happy and long marriage.
77 years,
I think. Yes, and in fact, died very shortly after his wife, which often happens. I mean, they often talked about being codependent, you know, that in the sense that they were heavily dependent on one another, got to join them together. They had a real sense of being a team and of being together. And yes, it's interesting that, as so often happens, shortly after his wife died, he also died.
It's a very good tribute to him on the Gospel Coalition website. Maybe we should link that after
in the show notes. Yeah. Jimmy Carter, who's died at the age of 100, former US president. Let's talk about another prime minister, a leader of the country
dead.
Who's not dead, but has resigned. And that's the Canadian prime minister, Justin Trudeau, who's resigned after 9 years in office, leader of the Liberal Party. This is an interesting one because it feels like he resigned before he was pushed. There was increasing disquiet, it seems, within his party over a number of policies, pressure from Conservative opposition in Canada as well. How do we review this?
We ought to say, politically, as Christians, we're not so full of praise for Justin Trudeau as we might be for Jimmy Carter.
And
he has presided over an extraordinary deepening secularisation.
Huge liberal agenda.
Much further ahead in some ways than the UK. Yeah. I was just reading on the BBC website just this afternoon that that one in 20 deaths in Canada are now from euthanasia.
Yeah, I picked up on that when we were having the assisted suicide debate
it's
here.
It's extraordinary, really. Yeah. So in terms of, you know, we're not commenting here on the policies he's enacted and his politics. I think the reality is he has basically run away, stepped down because there is disagreement within his party about how the party should be managed and how the country should be led. He's lost a key ally, Chancellor, I think, or the equivalent of the Chancellor, lost a key ally. The economy is in trouble anyway, and the trouble is likely to increase. Trump is talking about day one tariffs to
Canada.
Yeah,
I mean, that seems like a huge issue for Canada.
Be enormous, whether that just proves to be bluster or not, we don't know, but that could be enormous. And so actually it's a very, very difficult time for Canada. So clearly he was losing, maybe even had lost, but was definitely losing the confidence of his party, wasn't willing to fight that. And so it looks like very much his step down rather than being pushed.
Lessons, John?
Well, I think one level leadership is always with consent. And it's clear in that situation that he was no longer enjoying the consent. Political leaders are elected because they reflect the will of the population at a particular moment. But when that is lost, it's no longer possible to continue to lead. So there is a right and proper place for leaders stepping down when they recognise that they no longer command the support that they may well have done. So at one level, by stepping down, I presume that he's hoping that somebody else might be able to come in and lead the party and may well be able to, in a sense, change things and gain popular support again. So at one level, he could stay and fight, but that would be, to some extent, futile. There is a point at which leaders need to recognise that they themselves have lost that consent. To some extent, Joe Biden did that in stepping down from being re-elected as American president when he sort of realised that there wasn't really a great chance for him being able to win. One might compare that with Boris Johnson, who tried to cling on when he'd lost the support of large numbers of his cabinet and population, and was actually forced out in a rather undignified way. So there is a moment in leadership at which it is best for the country, the institution or organisation that you're leading, for yourself personally, to recognise that that is no longer a position that you should occupy because you don't have the consent and the support of those that you are needing to lead. And that's a difficult judgment for people to make. Now, it's certainly true that he's left knowing that he would probably have lost, might have been forced out. So, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Do you stay on to fight for something that's really important because you think that's what you need to do, or do you recognise that it's in everybody's best interests, including your own, that you step away because that consent has been lost?
I mean, there are clearly some people who stay on too long. There are probably other people who need to have a bit more, I was going to say fighting them, that's not the right expression.
Stickability?
Stickability sometimes. And it's difficult to know in this situation because we're not intimately involved in Canadian politics. It's difficult to know exactly which it is. But I think for us as leaders, there are clearly some leaders that cling on too long in church life. and need to read the room, basically, if it is by consensus and trust that they lead, and that's been lost. But equally, there are some people who will run away from things very quickly. I mean, I think we're not anything like this in the UK, but it is interesting that the average length of a pastor in a Southern Baptist church in the States is something like 3 years. It's just an extraordinary statistic. I mean, so we're nothing like that. But there clearly is a temptation in leadership that as soon as things get a little bit difficult, just walk away from it, go preach my sermon somewhere else. And we want to fight that as well.
And we do see that, don't we, in local church life. We have situations in which there's a pastor and maybe has a small group of difficult people in the life of the church who make it very difficult for him to lead. Yeah, he actually has the support of the majority of the congregation, who may often be a silent majority, but they feel forced out because of just the pressure of having to deal with a small vocal group who want to undermine their leadership, and they don't quite have the willingness to keep dealing with that. On the other hand, you've got the pastor who, in a sense, has lost their congregation, that they no longer have their support for all sorts of reasons. That may be fair, it may not be fair, but the reality is they no longer command the support of the church, but they feel they've got an entitled right to remain there no matter what, and actually carry on leading the church way beyond the point at which they have the support of the body that they're leading.
So let me just push on that. What does discernment look like for somebody?
Well, I think we just need to be honest up front that actually if you're in that first situation you're describing, John, if you have got a small vocal group of people who are against you, even if you have the overwhelming majority of the church with you, that can be a very tough situation to minister in. It can be wearing, it can be personally challenging, it can be, you know, you can lose sleep over it, you can become anxious about it. And there may be people listening who are in precisely that position, but they know it's just one or two people in the church or a small group. But actually, we feel for you. We know what it's like. It can be really, really difficult and really, really wearing. So I think we've got to be difficult. We've got to be just cautious about condemning people who walk away from those situations, because we all have different capacities, and you do need to know yourself. So I think that's part of it. You do need to know yourself, and we need to be clear that one person's capacity to withstand critique and criticism might not be the next person's. So we are all wired differently. So I think it's we've got to be cautious about drawing.
You can't do a blanket.
You can't draw sharp. Yeah, you can't draw sharp lines. But equally at the margins, we want to be able to say we probably could all do with being a bit more resilient, and we could probably all do with being a bit more sensitive, both at the same time. So I think actually those are skills to nurture. Skills. Those are gifts, qualities for us to nurture as leaders in ourselves, and to ask God to grant us more of.
Yeah. I mean, discernment, I think there are several elements to that. There's obviously the personal discernment before God, of prayerfully reflecting on our situation where we are, seeking his will and guidance, knowing our own capacities in the situation. I think there's then listening to the people that you're leading, the congregation that you're engaging with, and paying attention to them and what they're saying, and actively seeking their input and their feedback. And then there's the great benefit of the counsel of those outside of the situation who are able to advise you. So I don't think discernment is done sort of solely individually. Discernment involves that sort of wider group of people, sort of that relationship with God, relationship with the church, relationship with trusted advisors. And it's all of those together that help you to discern what's right in this particular moment, from people who know you and know the situation and can help you to work through those very difficult judgments. Because there isn't necessarily a right answer, particularly as Adrian was saying, where you're facing difficulties in the life of the church. It's not necessarily obvious what is the right thing for you and the church at that point. And when you're the pastor who's lost the church, you might not see it. And what then you need is friends who can say to you, you need to sort of recognize reality here and help you to see what would be best for everybody.
It's interesting. And just introduced in his resignation statement, he said he'd been talking to his family about it. He'd shared with his family.
Well, the night before.
But do you think you don't think there'd been other conversations?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, he said he'd told his family the night before. I didn't know.
Maybe it was more self-reflective than I had understood it.
I mean, it's worth saying, actually, because when we read the New Testament, criticism is inevitable in leadership, whatever group of people somebody's is in. The idea that there's going to be an environment in which somebody's leading a church or a group of elders are leading a church, everybody is permanently happy with what's done and where it's at. Actually, the New Testament is full of internal disagreement and the pressure of criticism. The real question is whether or not that criticism is justified and how it needs to be responded to. But the very nature of leadership is that you will get significant criticism from people who either don't like you, don't like what you're doing, don't like sort of the way that an organization is going. That is part and parcel of leadership.
We've talked about two political leaders. Let's talk about a church leader who's also finished his time in his current ministry in the new year, and that's Justin Welby, the Archbishop
of Canterbury. Has a seat in the House of Lords. Does that make him a political leader too?
Well, I'm not getting into that. But the ceremony, he laid down his crozier, didn't he, in the early part? I think it was the 6th of January.
He's got all the tech language.
Well, I know. I have a brother who's an Anglican. I kind of know what I'm talking about in this regard. But there we are. But he has finished his stint as Archbishop of Canterbury. How will he be remembered? We talked previously, and we can link to previous in the news is about the Macon Review, the reasons for his stepping down. But actually, how will he be remembered as the leader of the Global Anglican Communion? Let's ask these two independents.
I want to say at a human level, I feel quite sorry for him and what he's had to face. I think he's had an almost impossible job to do. The Anglican Church is so divided in itself, and one shouldn't forget that he inherited a mess of issues that had not been resolved and not been sorted out, a declining church. None of the recent archbishops have really been able to do a good job and revitalise the church and bring about unity. Not George Carey, not Rowan Williams, not before that Robert Runcie. So the Church of England from the outside looks to me like an almost unleadable organisation. Between people who are greatly opposed to one another, and also this worldwide grouping that you have to have some leadership over, but isn't really in a sort of formally under your authority. So I think it's an almost impossible task to have undertaken for anybody. I would imagine that as people think about who could take this task on, there needs to be some recognition that this is a, humanly speaking, an extraordinarily difficult task.
You can't hold it together, can you?
Well, I don't think you can, but yeah. I think that's one of the challenges. Having said that, there are lots of ways in which I think, rightly, Justin Welby has been criticised, particularly by evangelicals. He has compromised his position on sexuality and not been willing to be absolutely clear on where he stands on that, has not taken a firm stand for dealing with the truth in the light of the Anglican Communion. So he's tried to hold things together by compromise and fudge. And then eventually it turns out that his own personal position has changed. I think that's been dismaying to evangelicals. He's been criticised for having primarily a managerial approach rather than a pastoral or theological approach, which has seen the church decline and a centralisation of power. And there is certainly a feeling on the ground that he has not supported the work of parish ministry, which is where the main work is done and operated with the organisation. And then, of course, there have been the criticisms of the way that the church has handled safeguarding issues, and particularly his own personal responsibility for John Smythe and whether he did enough to enable that to be investigated. So I think he steps down and in a situation in which lots of people are critical of how he is led and what he has accomplished. I think it's obviously too early to evaluate everything, but I think those are deeply concerning issues. And I think from the perspective of evangelicals, it's been very disappointing. Here is somebody who came from the strongest, most rapidly growing evangelical section of the church, kind of more charismatic evangelicals, his background in HDB, New Wine, that kind of world. People thought this would be change and it would be a way forwards. And I suspect that at one level, it has proved a disappointment that an evangelical has not been able to turn around the Church of England in the way that people might have hoped.
I think there's also, he has suffered from the fact that the church he leads is intimately caught up with state. Mm-hmm. So church and state are very, very closely connected legally and historically and morally in all sorts of ways in this country. And I wouldn't want to have any responsibility in that sort of area. So he's often been criticised, for example, for speaking up about, you know, food banks or poverty or various other issues. And I think I see where some of that criticism is coming from. You know, he's not speaking up about the gospel, although I think you don't necessarily hear everything he says. But actually, once you integrate church and state,
Those are the issues you have to speak on.
So I feel it's a bit of a, you know, between a rock and a hard place. So a bit like John, I do feel sorry for me in that sense. But I'm not an Anglican by conviction. I'm an independent by conviction. I do think church and state should be separated. So I do think that's an unenviable position and almost an impossible position for any Christian really to kind of speak the gospel into on a regular basis. I think it's very difficult.
And again, in a personal, he's been very honest about his own struggles with mental health. So he's mm-hmm. held that leadership role with those issues. That's also been true within his family. So at a human level, again, one can have a great deal of sympathy for him and what he's wrestled with. And it's very difficult because sometimes he speaks and you think those are great gospel things that you're saying. And then you have these other elements which seem to be an undermining of core gospel truths. And what do you make of that? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Lessons for independent leaders. I mean, just thinking about... You've talked a bit about church and state. We can't turn the pulpit into a place for politicking. Is that a lesson?
We do. You know, we want to, as the Bible addresses things, we do want to be addressing things. That must be right.
Yeah, but I don't espouse your politics from the pulpit.
No, I don't think you do. Yeah, and we don't have a seat. You know, we don't have seats in the House of the Lords by virtue of our position. I think that's right. I'm very happy with that separation. I'm quite convinced. You know, I've got convictions about that. I think that's a healthy place to be. But I don't think that means we have to be apolitical. I think we have to be careful.
Yeah, that's not quite what I'm saying. No. I just mean you can't hijack the pulpit for a political agenda. No. That's the point I'm making.
I'm not sure that Justin Welby was. It's just that every pronouncement he made was seen almost ex cathedra, wasn't it? It was seen as something he was speaking as the Archbishop of Canterbury. And I think, you know, as church leaders, we do need to be allowed to have personal views on stuff. I think that's quite important. You know, we do need to be able to support one football team and not another.
Yeah.
I think in many ways, leadership, you have to know what your unchangeable convictions are. Mm. And the fundamental problem with the Anglican Church is that people have a variety of different convictions. And unity as the ultimate goal can't be what ministry is about. So much of this is about trying to achieve unity between people who hold diametrically opposing views about the nature of sin, about whether or not sort of certain human behaviour is acceptable to God, pleasing to God, to be celebrated, or is wicked and to be repented of. And I think the danger of that role is if you think the primary task is to maintain the unity of the institution, you will inevitably compromise on your positions. There is a place in which you have to recognise we are so different in our thinking that we cannot possibly stand together and say that we all represent. Mm.
Do you think we're too ambitious then? I mean, I think, you know, we're looking in from the outside, it's very easy for us to be critical, isn't it? We've got to be a little bit careful about that. But in a sense, the Archbishop is chosen from bishops. You have to be a bishop to be the Archbishop. I think that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not actually.
Is it not?
No, they can nominate anyone to be Archbishop of Canterbury.
Yeah, I thought you had to be a bishop. Oh, well, I stand corrected. But presumably you've already bought into the breadth within the Church of England, haven't you, in order to be serving in a sort of a lesser role. Mm. So do we expect too much from an archbishop?
It's difficult. It seems to me that lots of people who go into the Anglican Church, they sort of recognise the breadth, but they think that they are the true and authentic Anglicans and that they will be able to fight for their party. And as they get higher up the hierarchy, you have to do more and more work of holding together the different parties because you're no longer leading just an individual church. Yeah, yeah. And almost by definition, the people who will be appointed to those roles are people who are holding together that diversity. And I just think that's a very difficult position in leadership. You have to accept at some points you can't be together. Now, of course, the countervailing side to that, which is also true for, I think, independence, is to know where it doesn't matter where you differ. Because at one level, there is the danger of maintaining unity no matter what. Mm. The other danger is of not having unity unless you're absolutely agreed on everything. And even within Anglicanism, the 39 Articles and the position of the Church, they state a sort of a broadly Protestant reformed position, but they give lots of space within that on a whole load of issues that Anglicanism doesn't tie down, which is slightly different to Presbyterianism, where everything is actually detailed in the Westminster Confession and the Catechisms. So in a sense, there's a possibility to hold together within the spectrum of that doctrinal position, but boundaries that need to be policed. Mm. The problem in the Church of England is the boundaries haven't been policed. But there ought to be that then freedom within those boundaries. In that sense, that's not unlike FIEC. That's what we are. We are a body with a sort of a statement of faith and some positions which we all hold to. But within that, there's a diversity of views on a whole load of specifics. And I think the challenge for us as leaders is managing to do both of those things.
Mm. One more leader before we finish. So we are on the cusp of the inauguration of Donald Trump as president again of the United United States. He's already been kind of...
Greenland.
Mexico, this is what I was going to say. He's already been kind of flexing his political muscle, as it were, and sort of talking in various parts of the world about various different things. But what do we make of this? And what can we learn from this?
Well, I think it's a bit too early to say, without wanting to say nothing for a moment. There's quite a lot of bluster comes from Donald Trump. We know that. So, for example, you know, going to fix the Ukraine-Russia situation on day one. Well, he's just appointed a general, General Kellogg, from the famous Kellogg family, General Kellogg, to oversee all of this. And he's given it a 100-day period. So I think you have to separate out what is electoral blustering from actually what will happen. There are some comments coming out of Mar-a-Lago, his sort of, you know, headquarters in Florida, that actually he's surrounding himself with a more serious team at the sort of advisor level. Again, I don't know whether that's true or not. We'll have to wait and see. Some of his appointments, I think, into positions like the secretaries of various departments look to us like a little bit odd. You know, it's sort of rewarding mates who have some strange ideas, and how's that going to work out? You know, the health secretary and his views, and how's that going to work out? And so I think some of it is wait and see. But I think, in his first 4 years as president, I think a lot of the things that he'd been talking about leading up to his presidential inauguration didn't actually come to pass. So I don't know. I've just spent a long time rambling. Sorry. I think actually the jury's out.
John?
I think that's right. There's a lot of rhetoric. Quite what that will be translated into, we don't know, because reality is difficult to change. The reality of economic performance, the reality of world politics, you can have a rhetoric about what you're going to do about it, but the facts are that's very difficult to perhaps change on the ground. I mean, we've seen that with the Labour Party. They come in with all sorts of statements about how they're going to bring out growth and change, and actually it's a whole lot more difficult to do that in reality. Yeah. We must, I think, remember that Donald Trump is a human being. He's flawed. He has strengths and gifts. Who knows how it will turn out on the ground? He's not the savior, nor should we necessarily instantly dismiss him as somebody who...
And we should be praying for him.
Absolutely. I think we need to recognize that the things that have got him elected and the issues on which he has spoken that attracted support, we need to pay attention to and recognize. So people are concerned about the economy, they're concerned about inflation, they're concerned about culture, they're concerned about immigration, they're concerned about sort of control over their lives, they're concerned about the implications of diversity, equality kind of programs that mean that they don't feel that they're then treated fairly and that they're treated unjustly. And there is a groundswell of people who are therefore dissatisfied with the way that society has been operating. And we need to recognize that. And I think the Bible would say that some of those things are absolutely right. He is sort of recognized some of the sort of consequences of liberal progressivism and how it's working out in people's lives. Whether he will be able to translate that into something that improves the lives of people remains to be seen. So, for example, you can talk about setting up tariffs that prevent goods being imported. Tariffs generally lead to then inflation, which will make the cost of living even more. So it sounds like a great thing to do. If you actually do it, you may well end up actually creating the very circumstances that cause people to be alienated in the first place. So I think we have to reserve our judgment and see what is actually done.
I think we do need to acknowledge that the United States is the world power. Militarily, that's true. Economically, that's true. Number of people, not quite true, not comparable to, say, India, China, but still a very, very large nation. And so I think even though he's not our president, we do need to be prayerful about what happens in the States. We do need to be prayerful. We're praying for governments. You know, the injunction to pray for our leaders in 1 Timothy 2 is so that we might enjoy quiet lives. And so you think, well, how does that directly apply to us in America? Well, actually, we ought to be praying that for Trump, because we want our American brothers and sisters to live quiet lives. Yeah. But also we realize that actually, frankly, the appointment of President Trump is more significant to us internationally than who's the president of Greece.
And I think we have to recognize he holds his position because God has raised him up to that position through all of the circumstances. His moral failings of character and relationships are well known. The Bible doesn't say that sort of people who are flawed in that way cannot fulfill the function of civil government that God has for them. You can have, in a sense, bad people who are good in government. That's not an impossibility if they perform their tasks for the benefit of the common good. So I think we should be praying that God would be at work through that situation. And we must remember that he is ultimately accountable to God for what he does. We ought to pray that he would realize the weight of that. Certainly as American president, you have the opportunity for contact with all sorts of kind of religious Christian leaders who can speak into that situation. So pray that they would speak the truth without fear, and that God would be merciful and be at work.
Well, there we are. We've talked about Jimmy Carter, Justin Trudeau, Justin Welby and Donald Trump, lessons for leadership at the beginning of 2025. Brothers, thank you so much for helping us through that. And thank you for listening to this In the News special. Do rate, leave a review so others can find it. And we'll look forward to speaking to you again soon.